Okay, Tokyo, Australia, Germany.
Go head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! And there's the mic preamp again. How about that? A minute past the hour, and we're off and running on this Friday on the front porch on the horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where we live. That's where you go if you want to jump into the chat room, which I would love to do. As soon as I get a reboot on the computer, I will. But you'll be in very, very good company. I just don't happen to know who's in there right now. Except being pretty sure that longtime, inveterate, indefatigable chat room moderators Lottie and Sparky are there to keep everything happy and sane. This is, of course, also a listener-supported broadcast undertaking. Well, wasn't that interesting? Huh. A bunch of stuff just fell down. I wish the ghosts would stop doing that. But it is a listener-supported undertaking, and we try to raise $200 every evening. Came up a little bit short last night, but it's not terrible. We need to raise about $330, and there are still slots available in the secret open carry Roundup Society offer from this week. We've got seven more chances to round up. That means every contribution that comes in gets rounded up to the nearest dollar amount and an extra $10 thrown in on top of it. Isn't that nice? Yeah. So, like I said, about $330 to go. 33 at 10, 10 at 33, and beyond that, my Cyphron and Gazintas aren't worth a damn, and we'll be okay for the week. Now, it is Friday on the front porch, and about 58 minutes from now, we will begin the extraordinary, ordinary roundtable that puts the big red bow on the end of our week here at the Horn. I am now restarting the production computer in hopes that it will behave. Thank you, Carol Baker, Queen of the Minions. She says you're on. Yeah. Is this thing up? Hello? Right. But thank you very kindly, and thank you, Thomas. Loud and clear. Sounding great now. Send me some soup for the apocalypse on FYINation.com. No soup for you. Right. Yeah. So, if you've never participated in the Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable, well, you are certainly welcome to, as long as you're not a right-winger. They're not allowed here, you know. All you have to do is send a contact request on Skype to Sparky Dunk, SparkyDunc, on Skype, and he will show you the breadcrumb trail and light up the Bob signal so that you can find your way into the Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable that is the Horn Molloy Skype chat group during Friday on the front porch. Okay, so I think we've gotten most of the stuff taken care of. Mm-hmm. And, well, let's see. What do we have for the next hour or so? What do you say we get the evening started with some genu-damn wine crazy, shall we? Yeah, do let's. This will be fun. Wrong button.
He wrote your Declaration of Independence, South Carolina. Can the liberties of a nation? This is what Jefferson said 240 years ago.
Want to bet he didn't.
Can the liberties of a nation be secure when we have removed a conviction that these liberties are the gift of God? Indeed, I tremble. He was trembling 240 years ago.
Thomas Jefferson, according to Duck Doofus, was trimming 240 years ago. We don't know what he was trimming, but he was trimming. You heard him. He said he was trimming. But insofar as Jefferson was a notorious deist, the odds that he actually said that quote that Duck Doofus in South Carolina said at a Rafaelito Eduardo Cruz, anointed future king of America, son of Rafael Eduardo Cruz, the man who forgot to become an American for a really, really long time, rally. Well, I'd say it's about 1,000,000 to 1 that Jefferson ever even said that, because this is just more of the stuff that being evangelical fundamentalist Christians, amosexuals, you know, that they just make up, because being good, God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, fundamentalist, amosexual Christians, they're liars. Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, and by the way, here's a fun thing you can do. You can just sort of help this keep moving until Google decides to step in and make it go away. You remember what happened after Rick Sanctum Santorum, Bro-Fro-Mix? Remember how he got to be Bro-Fro-Mix? You remember when Rick Santorum said that allowing all people who love each other to marry regardless of gender? Remember how he said that would lead to man-on-dog sex? And so he became known as Man-on-Dog Santorum, and thanks to the brilliant Dan Savage, there was a Google bomb was put out such that when you searched Rick Santorum's name, the first thing you came up with was the definition of Santorum, namely a frothy mixture of et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and this is the dinner hour. Sorry, Scott. Sorry, Linda. I won't take it any further than that, but you remember how that happened. And it has stuck to Bro-Fro-Mix, Man-on-Dog Santorum, ever since. Well, something similar is happening out there in the world of the interweb tubes, and you can help. You can help. You can participate. It's a little bit of free activism that you can do just to try to make life a little more interesting for Rafaelito Eduardo Cruz, the anointed future king of America, son of Rafael Eduardo Cruz, the man who forgot to become an American for a really long time. Mm-hmm. And what you can do is this. Go to the Google and start typing, is Ted Cruz the, and then when it populates with Zodiac Killer, go ahead and click that, because that's a thing. I've done it several times on several different devices, just trying to help the algorithm along a little bit. I don't know how this got started, but it is damn sure fun, downright precious. Is Ted Cruz the? And then odds are it will populate with the words Zodiac Killer. And that's just absolutely charming. Yes. Because he sure is creepy enough, isn't he? And he's just got that, psychopath look in his eye. And he's apparently been a giant dick from the moment he was born, or at least from the moment that they poisoned his mind inside the upstanding, God-fearing, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, fundamentalist, amosexual industry. Is Ted Cruz the Zodiac Killer? Now, realistically, it would be kind of difficult for Rafaelito Eduardo Cruz to be the Zodiac Killer because some of the killings took place, before Rafaelito Eduardo Cruz was born up there in Alberta, in Canada, where his mother was registered to vote because she's a Canadian, not an American, and he can't be president. But there are coincidences. He was born in Calgary, and I don't even know if this is true, but two of the Zodiac Killer's victims were Cal and Gary. Read the book. Oh, yes. But enough. When last we checked in with Duck Doofus, we were lying about things that Thomas Jefferson said. Lie on, Macduff, and truthful be he who first cries enough.
Why are you so afraid, Mr. Jefferson? I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever.
Nope, Jefferson didn't say this.
240 years later, South Carolina, I am really, really trembling.
Clap, you Bible bangers, clap.
You say, Phil, are you running for anything? No.
You say, Phil, are you crazier
but
than a sprayed roach?
I'm not running
from
anything either. Listen to this logic.
Oh, is that what we're calling it
the
these days?
The Supreme Court building has a number of places where there are images of Moses with the Ten Commandments inside the building.
Inside.
Moses is including among the great lawgivers in Herman McNeil's marble sculpture. It's on the east front. As you enter the Supreme Court courtroom, South Carolina, listen to this.
Yeah.
The two huge doors that you walk through.
Huge.
Ten Commandments engraved on them on both sides. Hanging above the head of the Supreme Court Justice.
You know, he's not going to say is the sword of Damocles because Phil Robertson couldn't pronounce Damocles or even know who Damocles was on his best day. But now an architectural design choice has become, you know, the source of law in the United States. He's already the point where he is banging on the lectern. I imagine the shoe will be off in a matter of minutes. Oh, by the way, thank you to a number of you for kindly reminding me to fetch the cheap rot gut tequila. I did. So if it gets particularly bad, there will be swigging taking place. Yeah, I just like that. I love that sort of calm, shattering, the shudder of cheap tequila with even cheaper political rhetoric, such as this. Bang on, Phil, bang on.
Guess what's hanging there? It's right above his head.
Right above it.
The Ten Commandments.
Yeah, boy.
So what do we do? We start hauling the Ten Commandments out of all the courthouses. You say, but they kept them there. They're still in the Supreme Court room where they meet.
Room, yeah, whatever.
Give them time.
Room, closet.
They'll haul them away.
Coat check.
Let me get this right. If you're in South Carolina or if you're in Louisiana and you violate commandment number five, children, honor your father and mother. You didn't discipline your kids, you didn't raise them right. So they get out there and they go down the road tearing up, getting all drunked up and stealing stuff and tearing people's property up.
Uh-huh.
And when the laws catch them, where do they take them, South Carolina? To the courthouse. Where we just got rid of the Ten Commandments.
I think he got to the tequila before any of us did. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this thing. Most of the Ten Commandments don't even have anything to do with good government. And the ones that actually do sound like law that we would recognize, we kind of flaunt on a regular basis. How about since he's a hootin' on number five, how about number six? Thou shalt not kill. Now, this guy's made a fortune making things, little noisemakers that make ducks think that he wants to have sex with them, that he uses to lure the ducks in, which he then kills. I mean, there's no qualifiers. It doesn't say thou shalt not kill humans. It doesn't say thou shalt not kill people that you like. It says thou shalt not kill. One would almost presume that the culture that originated that list and that particular commandment would be like a vegetarian culture, but no. Let's see, number eight. Well, that smacks of law. Thou shalt not steal. Yeah, we've got laws about that, and we haven't taken those laws away. No. Graven images? Nope, sorry. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. It doesn't say for purposes of worship, it means no graven images at all. So, interestingly, that statue of Moses that he's so fond of, Duck Doofus is, that's a graven image. And that says, don't make any of them. This is why, for instance, if you go into Muslim countries, you're not going to see a whole bunch of statues if they are seriously orthodoxly Muslim, right? This is why they get so worked up about drawing pictures of Muhammad. Dear God, it's too... it's too early. I can't take it, Carol. Ted Cruz wants Duck Doofus for UN ambassador. Quack, quack, quack. Yeah, he can just sit there in the great UN hall, and when somebody speaks that he doesn't like, he can, quack, 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 quack. Brother Deacon Asa asking, do we know if Jefferson was a constitutionalist like Ted is? Did Jefferson love Jeebus like Ted does? Huh? Huh? Well, sure he did, because his Jefferson exists only in the thin gray settlings that slosh around betwixt his ears that pass for brains.
Of which one of them says, children honor your father and mother. So what happens when kids don't honor their father and mother? The laws catch them, and they carry them to the courthouse, and they fine them or jail them. Number six, do not murder. It makes sense to me.
Unless the murdering is being done of ducks. Quack.
When you murder someone, I don't care whether it's South Carolina or Washington, D.C., the laws come after you, and when they get you, they're going to carry you to the courthouse. Right?
Right.
Drink.
Don't commit adultery. Gentlemen, if your woman catches you, there's a possibility you may have a court date. Right? Don't steal. You rob a bank. You burglarize someone's home. When they catch you, you violated what God said. You, what are we going to do with you? Courthouse bound. Every time. Don't lie. What did they do with old Martha Stewart, but she lied on that tax deal?
Yeah, it's a good thing we don't actually have a whole lot of lying statutes, because somebody'd come and take old Phil right away. To the courthouse. God almighty, what a dumbass. I mean, this here is what you call some authentic frontier gibberish. Oh, yes, indeed. And by the way, that business about the lying, and how if you tell a lie, they'll come and take you to the courthouse. Well, I just happen to have a photograph here provided to me kindly by Steve in New York. Who said, you'll note that the great big doors of the Supreme Court don't have the Ten Commandments on them. Each door is comprised of four bas-reliefs which illustrate significant events in the evolution of justice in the Western tradition. Number one, the Shield of Achilles. Number two, the Praetor's Edict. Number three, Julian and Scholar. Number four, the Justinian Code, which he might have mistaken for the Ten Commandments, but it ain't. Number five, the Magna Carta. Six, the Westminster Statute. Seven, Chief Justice Coke and James I. Chief Justice John Marshall and Associate Justice Joseph Story. That's eight. No commandments. Oops! Somebody better send a lawman to take old Duck Doofus away for lying again the Ten Commandies. So much stupid. So little time. Yo, and by the way, little note coming in from Ron and Raleigh just before airtime. I've been looking around, Ron says. Have you noticed? I've been looking around, and I've yet to find an article critiquing any of Antonin Scalia's more BS decisions, positive or negative. I guess people believe he was perfect. I haven't seen any pictures of him laying in repose, but I'll bet the line was long. Well, President Not Sure and Mrs. Obama went and paid their respects to his remains there, laying in state in the Supreme Court today. Of course, it doesn't matter. The Senate is still going to not let him do presidenty things, you know, because black, because Democrat. I mean, I reckon if it was Ben Carson, the Senate, the Republican Senate would be falling all over itself to let him do presidenty things. So it's the combination of black and Democrat that proves the problem here. Meanwhile, this is an interesting observation coming from Robert in Australia. You invade a country because you want their stuff. And what happens? Nothing happens. Get right. Subject line, duck dick. Jim writes, well, like the lady in Kentucky who can sit on her hair, he can sit on his beard and use it for other functions. This is too sick even for me. He's sick. Or There's all kinds of sick out there. Do continue, Duck Dick.
She end up courthouse. That's what I thought. And then you want more than you really need, and you're not satisfied with what you have, and you begin to look at your neighbor's stuff and whatever, and you covet. You say, you spend all your money. Hard times come your way. Then the bankruptcy kicks in. You say, where's that all happen? Courthouse. Now, I'm a redneck. I'm an educated redneck, but I'm a redneck.
Yeah, if you're educated, I'm the Padishah Emperor of the known universes. So do continue. It, meanwhile, with regard to Uncle Nino. Oh, I didn't realize that. President not sure paid his respects, but Carol tells me he's not going to the funeral. And the right-wingers are losing their effing minds over that. And by the way, the casket is closed. Carol says, I guess they couldn't get all the lipstick off. Yeah, who did he go there with? Yeah, there's that. Let's get that. Okay, educated redneck.
But if you're going to end up at the courthouse for violating the Ten Commandments, that might be a pretty good place to put them.
Hell. But see, nobody has ever been imprisoned in this country, at least not since the earliest days of the Massachusetts Bay Colony theocracy, for violating the Ten Commandments. Here in West Virginia, if you decide to steal, take, and carry away property of another, or goods or services of the value of more than $1,000 with intent to deprive the true owner thereof, you will be charged with a violation of West Virginia Code Chapter 61, not violation of a commandment. And in fact, the indictment will be brought in the name of the people of the state of West Virginia, and not in the name of God. See, Duck Doofus here secretly wants to live in a theocratic state. He wants Iran with more Jesus and duck call. Quack! And did I mention this is at a Rafaelito Eduardo Cruz rally? Yeah, okay. Yeah, you got to pay attention to this stuff. Gerald points out he didn't say how educated he was, Bob. Hell, first grade is educated, depending on your perspective. And then, of course, there's always you go to jail, not the courthouse. I bet Duck Doofus was so proud of himself when he came up with this little. This little oration. Yeah, here in West Virginia, we don't take you to the courthouse when you get caught violating the laws of the state of West Virginia. We have what is called a regional jail system, so you won't even necessarily get tooken to the county seat. You get tooken to the regional jail, which in this area is in Beckley. Yeah, there's one up in Flatwoods. Oh, we've really got a place in West Virginia called Flatwoods. But none of this matters to Duck Doofus. This is, shut up. He's on a roll. Straight out of Animal House. Quack, animal.
Give me a break. You say, this is the way. See, Ted Cruz is a originalist. He's like Scalia. When he reads the Constitution, he kind of takes old James Madison's advice. Oh, the strength of this nation will not be this Constitution, but the laws of God.
There's another one that James Madison never said. Yeah. Because they can't go a couple of minutes. They can't go 2-3 minutes without telling a lie. They can't deal with the actual history of this country without making crap up. Because, see, James Madison was not a religious man. Thomas Jefferson was not a religious man. George Washington was not a religious man. Ben Franklin? Now, they all recognized the role that religion played in ordinary people's lives, but these were men, many of them slave owners, of a time period called the Enlightenment. And one of the central tenets of the Enlightenment was that all the priestly gobbledygook had been not a good thing, but a bad one throughout the majority of European history. Thank you, Ryan. Skip a bit, brother. And the number of the counting shall be 3. 4 is right out, neither count thou 5. Once the number 3 being the third number be reached, lobbest thou thy holy hand grenade of antilock towards that thou, who being naughty in my sight, shall snuff it. Devoutly to be wished. I want to hear this phony James Madison quote.
You say, this is the way. See, Ted Cruz is a originalist. He's like Scalia.
Original.
When he reads the Constitution, he kind of takes old James Madison's advice. Oh, the strength of this nation will not be this Constitution, but the laws of God the Constitution is based on. You get rid of God, you get him out and keep him from being your anchor. When you start allowing men to determine what is right, what is wrong, what is good, what is evil, you let men do it, and they do not vet it through this book. Our founding fathers warned us over and over and over again.
Hey, dipshit, how many times have you eaten shrimp etouffee, fried shrimp burgers, shrimp gumbo, shrimp on the half shell, shrimp? How many times you've eaten that, duck dick? Because every time you've done it, that there book that's got the vets in it says that you should be taken from outside the city gates and stoned unto death. I bet you standing right there, duck dick, you's probably wearing some mixed fibers, like maybe the little bits of rubber in the waistband of your BVDs that's probably mixed rubber and cotton. You get tooken outside the city gates and stoned to death from your vetting book. What a piece of work. Oh, by the way, and here's a photograph of the that Supreme Court room, courtesy of Steve in New York. Steve says, well, hell's bells, still not there. Nope, sorry. No Moses. Not even in the bas-relief above the... Nope. And certainly they don't have a hanging Moses like unto the sword of damn oak leaves. You know what hangs over the head of the, and I'd be kind of nervous about it. You know what hangs over the head of the Chief Justice? A clock. A clock that operates on the godly principles of time established by, wait a minute, what, this business about running God out of anywhere, I thought he was the almighty creator of the universe. He can't run off an almighty. Or is God Eeyore? Thanks for noticing me. Jeebus.
And what you will end up doing and saying, well, I know it sounds like it may be a violation of commandment number 6, do not murder. But we're just going to go ahead and tell these ladies in America, American women, they can kill their children.
Yeah, because we do that. No, wait a minute. Actually, it's in his vetting book that it says, but it ain't the ladies, it's the men, the elder men. And when a child is disobedient and will not respond to the correction of his parents, then their book says that they are to take the children outside the city gates and throw rocks at them until they bash their little brains in and they gets all dead-like. That's in their book. It ain't in our law. And we don't have a law that says that ladies can go and kill their children. We do, however, acknowledge a constitutional principle that a person has the constitutional right to control the workings of her own insides. And that's a constitutional right, just like them guns he uses to slaughter the ducks when they come in close enough to thinking that he wants to have sex with them. Whack! I'm not rightly sure what it is that he thinks he little education goes a long, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, and he has very, very little indeed. All right, a little more, and then we're done with this twit.
Out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. Vet what you say through the Word of God. If you do, you know what? There won't be any vile, filthy language coming out of your mouth. God said, don't do it.
Never got around to reading that passage where the Song of Songs, Song of Solomon, whatever, wherein he talks about people's private man and lady parts. Yeah, it gets pretty vile and pretty damn, you know, quick. So that's what it sounds like to be in South Carolina, Stan, at a Duck Doofus rally. Or, I mean, a Rafaelito Cruz rally. And all of this comes to a head tomorrow, the 20th. Democratic primary is on the 27th, and there are issues surrounding that as well. I don't know if you ran across this, but Congressman Jim Clyburn wields considerable political power in South Carolina, Stan. He's a Democrat, of course. Not of course, but he wields power within the Democratic Party in South Carolina, and he has decided to endorse Hillary Clinton. He kept his counsel until the last minute, and he's hoping this will put her over the top in South Carolina. What you might not know, however, is what happened back in 2008 when Jim Clyburn endorsed Barack Obama. Because he did. Well, Jim Clyburn has a memoir coming out soon, or already out, I should say. And it's called Blessed Experiences, Genuinely Southern, Proudly Black. And in it, he recounts how back in 2008, after a primary, Bill Clinton called Jim Clyburn at 2:15 in the morning. Because, see, Hillary got plum thumped. Whooped. Stomped by Barack Obama in South Carolina. And after that whooping, Bill Clinton picked up the phone and called Jim Clyburn and said, "If you bastards want a fight, you damn well will get one." Clyburn said he had pledged neutrality to the Democratic National Committee as a condition of them authorizing the South Carolina primary, and wrote, "I had kept that promise. I asked him to tell me why he felt otherwise. He exploded, used the word bastard again, and accused me of causing her defeat and injecting race into the contest." Yeah. Make no mistake, when Bill Clinton gets nasty, he gets really nasty. Now, Jim Clyburn has endorsed Hillary Clinton. Explaining away the contradictions, Jim Clyburn said, "Spouses are supposed to support their spouses. Bill Clinton and I have talked several times over the past 8 years, and I certainly had no problems. He and I sat together at Senator Pinckney's funeral last year." Mm-hmm. You can tell, though, you can tell when a Clinton campaign is getting sideways just by measuring the amount of viciousness and vitriol that comes from them. It was back in 2008, of course, that Bill Clinton accused Barack Obama of believing in fairy tales. And now, of course, he is calling those of us who support Bernie Sanders, he's comparing us to the dimwit teabaggers. You may remember, I'm sure you do, our good friend Pastor Pillow, otherwise known as Eric Bjorn. If you run over to my Facebook page, Bob Kincaid, you will find there a reposting I did of something Eric has written. Eric is a wonderful writer. And what you'll find there is an open letter, I guess you would call it, an open letter to Bill Clinton from Eric Bjorn. The original piece is published at forwardprogressives.com. and it's powerful. Without ever having to use a single piece of invective or coarse language. Well, Eric says, I stood by you, as any faithful neighbor should. Boy, did folks toss some big old cabbages and tomatoes at your place in the day. Thank God those rose bushes were far enough back to protect them from a good TPing. He says, despite my years of ardent support this past week, and with a toss of the wrist, you threw me and millions of others, slick willy willy nilly style, under the Tea Party bus. That hurt, seriously. Ouch. Here were your words this past President's Day in Palm Beach County, Florida. It's not altogether mysterious. Wait a minute. Wrong voice. It's not altogether mysterious that there are a lot of people that say, well, the Republican Party rewarded the Tea Party. Just tell people what they want to hear. Move them to the right and we'll be rewarded. Except they didn't get anything done. Then that's going on now in our party. Because progressives who want everybody to be able to go to the doctor when they're sick, progressives who want students not to graduate from college with $250,000 in debt, progressives who want to see roads built and bridges fixed, progressives who don't believe in bombing brown people simply for the sake of bombing brown people, in Bill Clinton's mind, we are just like the Tea Party. You know, the Tea Party that brings signs, misspelled signs to rallies, saying, keep your government hands off my Medicare. Right? Signs that say, we come unarmed this time. Signs that say, Obama is the Antichrist. I, for one, welcome our new insect overlords. Yeah, those signs. Who think that we are better off if everybody straps on a shooting iron to run over to the local Wally World for a jug of milk and a loaf of Wonder Bread. Yeah, we according to Bill Clinton, we progressives are exactly like those people. Fuck you, Bill. Maybe it works. Maybe this will work. Of course, by extension, and people should consider this, he's essentially saying the same thing about Bernie and Bernie supporters now, the same tawdry, miserable, shitty things he was saying about Obama's supporters. Explaining why he supports Bernie, Eric says, why? Precisely because I no longer just hear what I want to hear. Because now, and for the rest of my voting days, I intend to vote my political conscience. Your immediate White House successor, whose name it pains me to type, forced me to seriously examine my political conscience. An eight-year-long famine of intellect and integrity, accompanied by a plague of warmongering, can do that to a voter. The W administration made me realize that for years I'd been a lockstep soldier of the center, whereas all along I possessed a decidedly left conscience. Go and read this piece by Eric Bjorn. ForwardProgressives.com, an open letter to Bill Clinton from a former neighbor and Bernie Sanders supporter. It's apparently getting some pretty good traffic. It's worth your time. What else? Well, one other thing. And this has nothing to do with Clinton. This is something entirely different. Something that I have not mentioned for yet because I've sort of been waiting for things to sort themselves out. I got this from Isaac. I started reading about this, a week or so ago. And it is troubling. You know that Alan Grayson is running for the Senate seat being vacated by little Marco Rubio because little Marco didn't much like being a senator like he thought he would. And another individual, also a Democratic member of the House, is also running for that vacant seat in the Florida primary. I think it's, what, August? Uh-huh. And, you know, Alan Grayson is an alleged progressive. But I'll bet you did not know that Alan Grayson is among the wealthiest members in the entire House of Representatives. Not among the wealthiest Democrats, but among the wealthiest members, Republicans included. Did you? Did you also know that Alan Grayson runs a hedge fund that was headquartered in the Cayman Islands? There are rules against doing that as a member of the House. It only gets worse. If you listened last night or to last night's program, whatever time you listened, you know that I spent some considerable amount of time talking about the differences between what happened in Flint and what's been happening in West Virginia for over 100 years. You may recall that my thesis was that it is easier to evince righteous indignation about what happened in Flint because there is no risk of stepping on any corporate toes. Yeah? Well, what we have with Alan Grayson is deeply disturbing. Because it turns out that the hedge fund that Alan Grayson runs has as its operative philosophy the idea that you can make a killing doing business in places where there is social and political chaos and turmoil. Well, it turns out that one of the things, companies in which Alan Grayson's hedge fund was deeply invested in the name of one of his children, is a an outfit called Nevsun, a Canadian corporation in the mining business. In particular, he was invested in a Nevsun operation in Eritrea, mining for copper and gold. And modern copper mining is disgusting under any circumstance. It never takes place anywhere near where any wealthy people live. It is almost exclusively in areas that are inhabited by indigenous peoples, unwealthy people, poverty communities, and they only get poorer. Eritrea is labeled a pariah state by Human Rights Watch. They haven't had an election in Eritrea since 1991. So that would be one of those places where there's chaos and turmoil. And so naturally, it would within that operational philosophy, yeah, you'd expect to see that. Incidentally, the Oak Flat section of ground sacred to the Apache people is slated for similar destruction by another mining outfit. FYI. Grayson has stood on the floor of the House and denounced U.S. trade with countries that engage in forced labor. Guess what? Eritrea, through a program, provided forced labor to Nevsun to operate those gold and copper mines. Being asked about Nevsun, Alan Grayson said, "The fact is, I didn't know, I couldn't have known, and I did nothing wrong, nor did my children. If I'd known, then I would have divested. I did actually divest, but I didn't know when I divested, nor would I have any reason to know that, given the fact that literally thousands of different investments are involved, given the fact that nobody brought it to my attention until I'm in the midst of a competitive campaign." Okay. Fair's fair. Consider this. You know that several people and I worked really hard to build a base of progressive support in the House of Representatives for the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act. We used to spend a lot of time in Washington, D.C. doing that before the money ran out. We got some pretty big progressive names on the bill, people like Keith Ellison and Raul Grijalva, who are the chairs of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. We got a number of members of the House Sustainability Caucus on board with the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign and the Act, so named, which in turn, you know, provides a means by which we can end the scourge that is mountaintop removal. I made, personally, I can't speak for other members of the campaign, except the ones that were with me at the time, but I made personally at least 7 visits not to mention emails and phone calls, to Representative Grayson's office. And I looked at him and said, this should be easy for you. You can't get a more progressive idea than the ideas that are embodied inside the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act. This protects people. This saves lives. This isn't some esoteric bill about saving some salamander. Not to say that salamanders don't need saving. Cute little suckers. And every time, a lot of nodding and earnest words, I'll get this right to the congressman. Nicole Sandler even asked him about it in an interview. Bupkis. Nada. Nihil. Niete. And now I wonder if I know why. Because if you'll invest in, you know, never mind the pariah state stuff. Never mind the Eritrea part. If you will invest in the environmental and social nightmare that is vast open cast pit mining for precious metals, why wouldn't you also be invested in the ongoing destruction of Appalachia? Because returning to my thesis, from last night, it is far harder to criticize practices that involve a threat to the moneyed interests of Wall Street. Than it is to rail against the products of mere partisan political hackery. I hope I'm wrong. I bet you I'm not. I'm getting messages saying, where's the chat room? Well, I mean, everybody, I'm not in there because I'm having computer problems here. But it's there. Go to headonradionetwork.com/chatroom. Should pop right up. Unless Sparky sends me a message or Lottie sends me a message saying otherwise. Back in June, Alan Grayson testified before the House Rules Committee against fast-track authority for the TPP. And he went on at some considerable length about how wicked it is to trade with dictatorships or countries that use forced labor. He said the following: when we buy an item that's imported from a country that has slave labor, that has forced labor, we're saying to the world we're okay with that. Well, I'm not okay with that, and I think that if we're going to have trade rules at all, we should have a rule against forced labor. That would seem to me to be a bare minimum of what we should expect of other countries if they want to trade with us. Wow. Why do we want to enter into commercial arrangements with dictatorships? How is that any different from entering into commercial arrangements with the Stalin regime or the Mao regime or the Hitler regime? 705. Damn it, Gerald. This is deeply disturbing. Deeply disturbing. Sparky says, if you're having a hard time getting in the chat room, try again. We're there. Well, I mean, I'm not, but you get the idea. Carol with a note just a few minutes ago. She said, you know what I like about this program? We don't tolerate hypocrisy from either side. And this Nevsun business and the Cayman Islands hedge fund business would appear to be a pretty obvious example thereof. And by the way, Alan Grayson said he had shut down his Cayman Islands hedge funds. But according to an article by Adam C. Smith in the Tampa Bay Times, Democratic U.S. Senate candidate Alan Grayson said more than 2 months ago that he had closed down his Cayman Islands-based hedge funds that helped prompt ethics complaints against the populist congressman from Orlando. He declined to provide documentation to the Tampa Bay Times when asked for it in early October, just as he did with the Hill newspaper several weeks ago. Feel free to check with Cayman Islands authorities if you regard that as relevant or useful, Grayson spokesman Ken Scudder told the Hill. So we did. Grayson's Cayman-based investment companies remained open as of Wednesday afternoon, according to official records provided to the Tampa Bay Times by the Cayman Islands Government General Registry. The interconnected investment vehicles Grayson set up in the Caymans, the Grayson Fund, the Grayson Master Fund, and the Sibylline Fund General Partner, are still listed as active. Scudder, meanwhile, said those records are wrong. And he forwarded an October 14th letter from the Cayman Islands Monetary Authority, which oversees financial services on the territory, confirming that one of Grayson's Cayman funds, Grayson Fund Cayman Limited, was dissolved. It's all out there, and it's quite complex and quite extensive. Go and read it. I like his politics. But that's disturbing. Yeah, and Ron with a message said, you went from sounding good to sounding great and for a couple of minutes, and now you're back at mere mortal. Well, see, I just kind of tapped on the mixer, and I think I went back to great again. But nobody's messing with the board. It just comes in and out because, well, it's old, and it's probably failing. I replaced the previous failing board with this failing board. That's what happens when equipment begins. It is constant daily use for years and years and years and years and years. There's a short in there somewhere. Maybe something with the preamp or the flageolet or the Knutton valve. I don't know. So that's where we find ourselves at the close of the filibobster. And I'm hoping during the Friday on the Front Porch segment, I'm going to rely on a little bit of Ron's expertise because I would like to discuss the foo-frog, and it's more than a foo-frog because it has intense ramifications for personal privacy. The controversy, the conflict, if you will, Ron says, quoting me, there's a short in there somewhere. Is that a Rubio reference? It can be if you want it to be, Ron. Asa tells me there was a big expose on Nevsun last week in our communist government-funded commercial-free TV channel, the CBC. The state, Eritrea, supplied slave labor to Nevsun, so therefore we never engaged in slave labor practices. The Nevsun rep said that with a straight face to the TV anchor, go figure. Look, mining companies are mining companies are mining companies, with all due apologies to Gertrude Stein. It's one of the reasons I'm enjoying WGN's Outsiders so much every week, because the people, the mining company, are behaving exactly like mining company behaves. It's almost like the creator of the program and the writers consulted with somebody who knew how those companies act. It's weird. They are rapacious. They are murderous. And they've got entire phalanges of lawyers who will go out and defend the murderous and rapacious practices. They've got members of Congress who will, the minute that the outfit is criticized, will say, "Yeah, but what about the jobs?" They are well trained. So I want to talk about the issue between the FBI and Apple, because while I was glad to see the FBI actually do its job with regard to the Patriots up in Oregon, that doesn't mean that they get a blanket pass for me, you, we, us, when they run around wanting to do things that they ought not. All right, then. We will fire up the Horn Molloy Skype chat group. And you, of course, can participate at will. Now, remember, we've got a problem with this. And I've spent weekends trying to sort this out. Eventually, the only thing that's going to fix the telephone problem here is getting a new telephone system. But that's another issue entirely. But if you call in on the stress line, you can talk to the Skype group. You just won't be able to hear them. And please be advised that everybody can hear you just fine, even if you don't hear what's coming at you so well. It works well for some, not so well for others. That number is 304-663-HORN, 304-663-4676. Of course, the Horn Molloy Skype chat group is moderated by Sparky, Sparky Dunk, SparkyDunc, on Skype. And we'll get that fired up now. And if everybody jumping into the Horn Molloy Skype chat group would please mute and stay muted until I bring you aboard, I would appreciate it. We still got $130 to raise this evening. Well, not anymore. Thank you very kindly, Roger. Taking advantage of the secret open carry Roundup Society's Roundup Week. Roger just got rounded up 99 cents to $4, and he got $10 added to that on top. So we are now at $316 to go to finish out the week. $316. Hopefully we can do that in the next couple of hours. couple of notes coming in. One from Thomas. Funds active is the subject line. It really pisses me off when guys I'm trying to believe in turn out to be even remotely dirty. I know. It's deeply frustrating. In regard to Alan Grayson, Steve merely says the 1% play by different rules. It's that simple. Or, to hearken back to George Carlin, there's a club, and you're not in it. Exactly. Break time. Time to fire up the Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable. This is listener-supported conversation radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. said, I love the heavy metal soundtrack. Veterans of the Psychic Wars. Yeah. So it is Friday on the Front Porch. And again, just because once the conversation gets started, it's kind of hard to break in with this reminder. We've got $316 to raise in about the next hour and 40 minutes. Hopefully, we will get that done. And instead of going over to the Horn Molloy Skype chat group first, well, let me do that first. Good evening, Sparky.
Good evening, Bob.
What I'm going to do here, I've got somebody on the Gizmo line, and I suspect I know who it is. And since whoever's on the Gizmo line can't hear y'all, but y'all can hear them, I'm going to go to the Gizmo line right now. Is that cool?
Cool here.
All right. I'm betting this is Harry. Oh, Harry.
Hello, yes. Hi, Bob. It is Harry from Baltimore. I'm happy to wait if you want to start.
No. Jump right in. Go ahead.
I don't want the Skype group to feel neglected.
They are not.
Well, I mean, in fact, I called specifically in a sense because it was the Friday on the Front Porch on the Skype group. And although, actually my message is, or what I'd like to talk about, and I'm sorry to say it has nothing to do with encryption, although I think it's a serious issue. I had just basically two things that I wanted to say, not so much to the Skype group. I think I'd be preaching to the choir because I think almost everybody in the Skype group, if not everybody, pretty much knows, agrees with me and has all feels the same way. So I'm sort of calling in a sense to talk to the people who are listening on, you know, the internet or are going to listen to this on a podcast or a recording later on. And I hope that's okay. And
sure.
As I said again, the Skype group, if they, you know, they'll probably, I'm not preaching to them because I know I'm with them. I'm preaching to the choir, and I want to talk just a little. I want to talk to the greater audience, I guess, if I can, just for a few minutes.
Yeah, the wider audience. Go right ahead.
Are you sure? Okay. Thank you. I'm a little nervous, and you know,
we've never had anybody faint mid-show yet, so you'll be fine, Harry.
All right, and you know, with the Gizmo line, I'm willing to do it. It's just, of course, it is a little strange on hearing. The familiar sounds of all of the veteran people, including Sparky, the person who keeps us all together on Friday night, and I'm very much aware of how much work he does, and I admire it greatly. Anyway, I want to talk about two things briefly, and one of them is sort of a question, but I know nobody can answer, so I'm just going to go ahead. First, I have two things, and in a sense, they basically both relate to Bob, your program and its future and my feelings about wanting it to continue on into the future as long as I'm alive anyway. And the first thing is, in the last week, I went to see, and this is sort of the upside or the inspiring side, within the last week, I was privileged to be able to see Michael Moore's new movie, Where to Invade Next. And I don't know how many people, depending on where they live, have seen this new movie. I actually had to wait about 2 months for it to come into enough or sufficiently wide release so that it came to Baltimore, because I had friends in Boston who saw it basically about 2 months ago, and they really urged me to see it. I mean, they knew I was generally a Michael Moore fan, but they thought this would really be very inspiring. And Bob, I guess I'm sure that you haven't had the time or the ability to go see it yet, but I would urge everyone to see it. And the reason is this. Okay, I'm not, you know, a really completely fanatic Michael Moore fan, but over time, and this only started in about 2009 or 10 when I first saw Sicko, which is not his first movie, but a movie I care about because I'm a very big advocate of single-payer health care. And after that movie, which moved me a great deal, I then went and tried to borrow library copies of all of his other films, and I've pretty much seen all of them. Maybe I'm missing one or two. But I have to say that Where to Invade Next, which has a strange title I know, is probably the best Michael Moore film, at least from my point of view, that he's ever made. And I'll say why just briefly. Michael Moore sort of has these various techniques that he uses. He puts together, film footage that he's gotten elsewhere, plus he tries to set up pieces where he's meeting people or confronting them in person, although he always acts, as if he's being very polite and very patient, et cetera. And then he kind of combines that with sort of more humorous set pieces where he's interviewing real people and, talking about very serious things often about social policy or capitalism or things of that nature. But he finds people who, in a sense, he can sort of play off because they're so amazed by the things that he might say, particularly about social and economic policies in the United States. So what he does in Where to Invade Next is he basically, and this is sort of in a sense an extension of things he's done in films like Sicko, where he took a group of people, one of whom is now the new executive director of a very active progressive group called Progressive Democrats of America. That's Donna Smith. But at the time, she was bankrupt. She and her husband were bankrupt, and Michael Moore rounded up a group of people who've been bankrupted by the medical system, and then he tried basically to find places where they could get health care, including going abroad, going to Cuba, and going to other countries as well, like France, etc. Anyway, in this film, he seems to have combined sort of this seeking better social policies abroad with his techniques for kind of poking fun at the United States, or even worse, or being wistful about the things that the United States does not do that some other countries do. And for each sort of social policy issue, he basically goes to each one country that, for various reasons he has heard about, has better policies than we do right now. For example, he goes to Italy and has this amazing interview where he's interviewing basically a lower middle class, maybe he calls them working class, Italian couple. And they have an amazing amount of vacation days per year. I mean, it's truly astounding. I mean, they get, weeks and weeks of regular vacation. Then they have lots of holidays when everybody gets vacation. Plus, they get a 13th month of paid salary, which is some tradition in Italy, and I don't know how far it goes back, and maybe fairly recent in terms of the labor disputes there. But basically, and then he tells them, for example, that under law, basically, although many organizations provide it, but under U.S. law, there's really no legal mandate for any employer to give anybody paid vacation. And I still believe that to be true. And, being a lawyer, I've never heard anybody, I know there are, variations on things, but that is still basically the situation here. There's no legal mandate to give paid vacation. And these people in Italy are just astounded. They're amazing. They're flabbergasted. In fact, they're so flabbergasted that he keeps talking to them because they are, in a sense, such great foils for this issue. Then, for example, he goes to Finland, and which, in fact, other people, and I've read this, have said, if you want to see the best education, public education system in the world for children, go see what Finland's doing now. And he goes. And even though he keeps it all in context and says about how Finland 20 or 30 years ago, or actually 40 years ago, really was doing badly, that they decided they didn't want that. They wanted to be better and have a better education system. And so, in a sense, while the U.S. public education system was basically, at least from my point of view, and various so-called objective indices going down the hill, Finland's system has risen to the top. And I think people have read about this. Certainly the professor here in the U.S. who was the inventor of the concept of multiple intelligences, which was a great breakthrough in terms of measuring children's abilities, he had told people at PBS that they should go to Finland and talk to them. So he goes to Finland, and it's truly amazing what they do. They do in their schools. The main thing is they have no homework or 10 minutes of homework, because they found out through research that children weren't learning more by taking home hours and hours of homework. And so they decided instead that children needed downtime, and that included at night and also during the day. And so they run their system in a way that almost sounds like, frankly, a Montessori school or a Walden school. I mean, it sounds so alternative, and yet it is the public education system. And he does this for other countries on other issues. He goes to Norway for its prison system, which he had sort of gave him a little peek at when he made Sicko, because Norway has this very non-punitive prison system, and basically doesn't believe in retribution or in punishing people. Their whole policy goal is basically rehabilitation. And in fact, it turns out that the longest criminal sentence in Norway that you can be given, even if you're a mass murderer, is 21 years. That's it. In fact, and he shows this because there was a massacre of campers on an island in Norway, summer camp, and
Anders
even
Breivik.
That person. Excuse me?
Anders Breivik.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear it.
Anders Breivik is the guy who did that.
Yes, that's right. That's right. He only got 21 years. So anyway, then he goes to other places, including Tunisia and Portugal. And in fact, there's this great place in Portugal where three policemen at Lisbon headquarters basically told him they wanted to make a statement to the American people. And these are both, you know, these are all kind of, I don't know, mid-level police officers. And they basically say to the camera, we want the American people to know that we think that the death penalty is just completely inhumane. It destroys everybody's dignity, and that the U.S. should basically stop it. And it's things like this, and it goes on and on. And I admit to being, you know, a sentimental person, but I was almost weeping by the end of the film, because there are these things, there are these policies. And here's the ironic thing. At the end of the film, he's walking with an old friend around the remnants of the Berlin Wall. And in fact, he discloses that he and this friend were actually in Berlin at the time when a few people started taking a chisel and a hammer and basically starting just, they felt like knocking at the wall and slowly knocking it down. And he talks about the fact that, you know, the Berlin Wall, everybody thought it would be up forever, never come down, and yet it did in a period, you know, a very relatively short period, based on a few people just starting to chip away and then other people realizing that it was okay, or maybe they felt okay to join them. And, you know, it all came down from there. So, but he says that he realizes that a lot of the policy issues that he's seen abroad that seem so wonderful, so humane, and there's always this talk, even when he's interviewing foreign CEOs, like in Italy, who are always talking about how, well, you know, we want the workers to go home on time because they're tired, and, you know, and we want them to have lots of vacation because they need rest, and they'll produce more when they come back. And they feel like, you know, and they're saying this is good for everybody, including the so-called, you know, management or the capitalists in Italy. Anyway, at the end of the film, he basically says, you know, a lot of these ideas actually germinated in the United States. And he shows old newspaper clips and other things showing that a lot of these ideas, in fact, did indeed, were originally suggested or maybe even pursued partly in the United States, but then, in a sense, we let go of them. We dropped them, or we discarded them. Certainly, over the last 40 years, there was there was a political force discarding a lot of these progressive ideas. And that's the sad part, because you see that there are all these social policies out there that we could have, maybe not right away, but we could have if somebody said, I want to implement them. And, in fact, right before I saw this movie, I was talking to there weren't many people at the showing. This was a matinee showing. Talking to these two senior citizen women who are both retired school teachers. And they live in the city of Baltimore. They live in the county, which I knew meant that it meant might be slightly more conservative. But they said that among all their friends, they were the only two who wanted to see this movie because their other friends didn't like Michael Moore or basically didn't believe that society should be more collective and that wealth should be redistributed.
Yeah, let me just guess.
People were just selfish.
Yeah, let me just guess. He's too liberal.
Right, exactly. Or actually, they just said these people are just too self-absorbed, and all they care about is their own, you know, survival and keeping whatever, you know. And
well,
then
I mean,
maybe
Harry,
some of them
this,
are retired.
Harry, this is a brutal country, and because
I know this, but here's my point, Bob, which is that you see. They started asking me because I told them I had worked in Washington more than 20 years, and I was telling them about, you know, kind of the culture of Washington, particularly since really the mid-1990s contract with America, and how, in a sense, brutal Washington had become, and how difficult it had become even just in Washington, even at private parties, to basically say what you really believe because you might be affecting the job of your spouse or your friend or whatever. And they said, well, but Hillary Clinton says she's practical, she's going to do things. And I said, well, and they were just apparently just, they told me later, they just wanted to know what I had to say. And I said, and they said, well, maybe Bernie Sanders can't do what he says he's going to do. And so, everybody will feel bad. And I said, well, shouldn't he be given the chance to do things that now seem unrealistic? And this was the point of Michael Moore's film also. You know, why do we ever think the Berlin Wall would come down in a matter of, I think it was weeks? Why was there a revolution in Tunisia that not only threw out a dictator, but also in the new Islamic constitution had several passages that explicitly enforced the rights of women? Why was it in, as he mentioned, why was it in, forgetting it. But the point is, he was saying things can happen, and you never know. And, it's like so-called Justice Scalia, oxymoron dying, You never know. So I'm saying I wish people would realize, and I know, people on the Skype group, certainly most of you listeners, I hope, are Bernie Sanders supporters. And I don't, I realize I don't care if it, some of it seems unrealistic. Or if the name, and even the New York Times has been doing hit pieces on Bernie Sanders, and it pains me because some of these things are going to be new. And every new healthcare system that went, that started in other countries, like the National Health Service in Britain after World War II, all of this was new. And even in Canada, when this was first introduced in Saskatchewan, it was new. And people were scared, and the doctors complained, and businessmen complained. But eventually, these things took hold. And I think that's sort of the point, which is that, change, if you've got to give change a chance. And I'm saying, after I watched Michael Moore movies, I thought to myself, who is the only candidate who's willing at least to risk things to make things better? Really risk, even if he failed. And as far as I can tell, it's only Bernie Sanders. And Bernie Sanders may not be perfect, and I know that some people on the left don't think he's even, leftist enough. But the fact is, he's the one with the best, as far as I can tell, with the best chance, or actually the most motivation to try to risk. Whereas, and I was explaining how Hillary Clinton, she says, I'm going to get things done because I'm practical. But who cares if she gets practical things done that don't change anything, don't make lives better?
I mean, Harry, that practical business for me is just it's a euphemism for incrementalism
how can anybody even truly believe that incrementalism will do anything? Because
precisely my point.
Because
when you say that we've got to be practical about people being killed in Appalachia,
I agree.
Hell kind of practicality is that? And you've raised wait just a minute, please. You've raised an issue here, and I think it's worth mentioning. I mentioned earlier in the program Eric Bjorn's piece over at forwardprogressives.com
about
why he's going to vote for Bernie and why he was, pretty insulted by that whole progressives are just like the Tea Party thing that Bill Clinton said.
Crap. I mean, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's disgusting. But here's what Eric said. And I want you to consider it because it is exactly what you're talking about.
Well, I don't want to waste your time.
But you're not. Just check it out. Just listen.
All right.
Because I think this will resonate with other people, too. Eric wrote, the audacious hope that MLK spoke of won't come to pass if Democrats march in baby step formation. Speaking of baby steps, let's imagine a more Democratic center version of JFK's famous 1962 moon speech. you know, getting to the moon is a nice goal and all, but for now, let's just build a satellite communication system. That itself would be quite the accomplishment. I think we have what it takes to get that by a Republican Congress. See how that goes for a few years. Monkey around with some rockets. Contract with a few German engineering firms. Then, you know, take it from there. I mean, it's not like we're ever going to get to the moon, people. Seriously, never,
yeah,
ever.
No vision,
but satellites,
no vision, no,
satellites
no
I
risk.
Could definitely see. You know, as compared to JFK, who said, we choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard, because that challenge is one that we are willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win.
Well, and, you know, you could say the same thing about FDR. I mean, I don't think he had any idea that any of his programs were necessarily going to work. He just knew that he had to try, frankly, in the beginning. Now, of course, he was a very, you know, gifted politician, but still, there was no guarantee that any of that stuff would work. And in fact, even the kind of economic theory that he ultimately, later in his administration, relied on, which is John Maynard Keynes, in the beginning, Roosevelt was skeptical about Keynes, didn't think that debt financing, you know, creating new jobs would do anything or would create the multiplier effect, even though they were, in a sense, jobs being artificially created. Keynes, even though he was brilliant, so he was treated politely, but my reading of the history is that when Keynes first came to America to visit Roosevelt didn't think much of. So, you know, we never know. I mean, who knew that Keynes would come up with a theory where he could show that even artificial government jobs actually helped the economy? In fact, they do what's called the multiplier effect. They increase the economy more than just by, in a sense, the value of what's being created. The multiplier effect is usually these days measured about, somewhere between 1.5 and 2. The idea is for every $100 or something that you spend on that you give to somebody in terms of an artificial government job, eventually the economy gets back $150. And so even debt financing eventually, because of things like, you know, the fact that people are now paying taxes, some or all of that debt eventually gets paid. So, you know, even that, I mean, even John Maynard Keynes, this brilliant Oxford economist, he even wasn't taken seriously at first. And it was only later he found out that by the beginning of Truman's terms that a lot of the economists inside the government were Keynesians. But they weren't that way in 1932.
No.
And anyway, here's my other point, Bob. You said last night about how, you know, that you were feeling a little, you were sorry if people thought you were talking about West Virginia too much, but you said, you know, this could be anywhere and your state or whatever could be next. And I fully, wholeheartedly agree with that, as I mentioned to you in an email earlier today, because, you know, that's true. And if it's not extractive industries, it's some other way that capitalism is going to be callously wanting to make a profit and destroy something, some other resource in some other state. And so I think, yes, we could say that Virginia is, in a sense, you know, why not talk about it? Because why is it so ignored? Why is it so disrespected out of all the states of the Union? And I realize that there may be cultural, you know, background to that and historical background, but if one state could be disrespected, why not other states? So here's what I want to say also, this is just briefly. My second point was this. You know, you mentioned Nicole Sandler, and I know you've been on her show once or twice, and I know she considers you a colleague and friend, and she put up about at least a year ago a list that wasn't scientific, but she said that, you know, people kept talking about, what about the liberal media? So she decided to put a list on her website of various kinds of progressive media in several different categories, one of which was yours categories, which is streaming shows and podcasts. When you're in there with Dr. Bill and even Nicole, that came out to 43 at that time. I don't know how old this list is, and it probably has not been updated all that well. But it was 43 different programs, including, you know, you and Dr. Bill and Nicole. Okay, 40. So then terrestrial radio shows and hybrids, only 17 at that time. And some of these probably don't exist anymore again. Then progressive, in a sense, network channels, where they try to, you know, aggregate various, you know, progressive radio programs, either terrestrial or internet. okay, 10. And at least one of these networks I know does not exist anymore. And the other one is yours, Bob. So we're down to like 8. Finally, then the last category, which is not really progressive radio, is the a category of progressive news blogs and progressive websites of, you know, progressive news. Only 28. And some of those are now gone. And I went back, in fact, to the web stream and podcast category, and actually some of those ones, because I was interested to see what they say. Some of those are either gone or else they are not nightly programs like yours. They're like broadcast maybe once or twice a week, and some of them aren't even broadcast live. Some of them are just, you know, made and then put out there like twice a week. So here's my point. I came to your, I started listening to your show in about mid-2011, frankly, after looking for anything as an alternative to NPR. I was a liberal then, I'm even more radicalized now. I don't even consider myself a liberal, but a radicalized progressive. But then I heard through Bob, through the Molloy show, I heard about you, and then a few nights later was able to find you and started listening. I haven't really stopped. And although I know that, you know, you've gone through periods where you've had equipment problems, et cetera, I'm saying, and again, not to the Skype group. And then I got to say, I've been poor for the last 3 years. I haven't, my bank account has had less money in it than it's had in the last 35 years, frankly. I haven't been able to donate anything, Bob, to your show, except as you may once recall, on my birthday last year, someone wanted to give me a gift, and I said, okay, please send some money to Bob Kincaid's show, because that was my only opportunity to get some money.
I do remember that, and it moved.
And it wasn't a lot of money, but
this person was
so desperate to honor my birthday that I said, okay, here's a short list, and, you know, you were, you know, the top of that short list, and this person did that. But my point is this. So I can't talk about raising money. In fact, I probably hate fundraising even more than you do, and I know that you don't enjoy having to do it every night. And I pray to God every night that you could stop doing this. I don't know, you know, where funding can come from, but the fact is that if things, let's say, even get just more chaotic, whether Bernie wins a nomination or not, it's clear to me from Nicole Sandler's list that we're going to need internet radio programs.
It ain't going to happen on terrestrial radio. I think that other list kind of proves that.
Well, yes. I'm sorry?
I think the terrestrial list proves it ain't going to happen on terrestrial radio.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, on this list, I mean, yeah, Mike Molloy is on here, but also Bill Press, who, frankly, I don't see as particularly progressive. He's liberal, but not progressive. And then shows that aren't, and then Stephanie Miller, who I sometimes feel is too much of a centrist. And then these shows that are like 5-minute, you know, broadcasts, like State of Belief with Reverend Welton Gaddy. I mean, you know, so this list of even terrestrial radio stations is way overestimated or overvalued. And yeah, so it's going to be internet radio, and you have pursued a, you know, I guess it's what, 10 or is it 11 years now?
Oh, we're past 11.
You've been running a daily network of programming, and yet, you know, I feel terrible because, you know, I know things like your studio in winter is very uncomfortable. And I say to myself, why should Bob be suffering to run this wonderful, progressive, great, you know, honest, no advertising, you know, internet radio station that, frankly, I believe we are really going to need. Whatever happens, if things get more chaotic, even if there's, you know, people in the streets, we're going to need your show even more than ever. And so, as I said, I have been, you know, unable to contribute, and I'm no role model, and I also hate even, you know, asking other people for money for voluntary activities that I'm involved, community activities I'm involved in. But I would just hope that people realize that your show, you have equipment, you know, not failures all the time, but, you know, equipment idiosyncrasies, et cetera, et cetera. And I just feel that we need to bolster your program so much so that your feet are not freezing when it's winter.
Well, I appreciate everything that you've said, Harry, and so much of it is so true. and you're resonating.
As it should.
You're resonating.
And so I'm saying, I know you hate to talk about it, so I'm sort of trying to get out. I'm kind of going out on the edge, like, and not really for you.
Harry, for some reason or another, you're breaking up. I don't know if it's on your end or mine. I hope you come back. But I think the point is well taken. And what I was saying a minute ago, you're resonating with people. James just wrote in and said, you know, if FDR, he said it's a good point, if FDR had simply jump-started the economy and not, one, created Social Security, and two, enacted the Labor Relations Act, there would be no middle class. Meanwhile, as regards the list, Nicole's list that you mentioned, Thomas says, Nicole just did that list recently. I helped her with one other person. Can't remember his name. She's doing it to get the word out so people can find them all in one place so we can work together, just so there was some follow-up on it. So thanks for that. Diane, meanwhile, said under the subject line, Lord Keynes, the Keynesian multiplier is less with spending on imports. I haven't looked at the net effect, but every time I buy something made in China, I think of it as a gross domestic income multiplier contraction. Those damn trade agreements. So even though it seems as though I have lost your audio, Harry, and for that I apologize. That's one of those, I don't know, maybe it's one of those technical idiosyncrasies you were mentioning. I do thank you for everything you've said. And if you want to call back now or some other time, you're equally welcome to do so. It's about 9 minutes before the hour. Let's run over and say good evening to the rest of the Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable. Good evening, Sparky. We're back.
Okay. One thing I forgot to tell you. There was a flaw in the mobile app tonight or something that people were having a hard time getting into the chat room. So Lottie fixed it, I guess.
Okay.
People are in there now.
Yeah, I think Java is going to die one of these days. It's just become almost unsustainable.
It always works for me.
Among other things, you're not running an Apple machine. It's apparent.
Oh, okay.
I mean, the emails I get, you know, Dear Bob, I have a Mac. Java sucks. You know.
Yes, it does. I tried all day the other day. I was trying.
That's part of it. I mean, I have chat room issues, and I'm running Windows 10, but I'm running it on a 32-bit. I'm running a 32-bit version, and there's only 4 gigs of RAM, and that makes it a challenge. Let's see here. Like I said, I did want to particularly address a couple of issues, and among things, let me send out another thanks to Roger. Roger just rounded up another one, so that takes us down to 93. That's 2, so that's 12. So that takes us down to 304, and thank you very kindly to Brian, who just took us to 284 to go. Thank you very kindly to Brian in Georgia. Thank you very kindly indeed. But
that doesn't constitute contribution abuse.
I'm sorry?
I hope that doesn't amount to contribution.
Oh, no, it doesn't. It contributes. You know, some people do Sudokus. Other people do crossword puzzles to keep their minds sharp. I've got you guys having me doing Cypher and Gazettas. So hopefully it'll help. And by the way, that means there are 4 more slots in the Secret Open Carry Roundup Society Roundup this week. And thanks to them, Brian's just got taken down. So we are at 274, which is good. Quick mention: Jason is trying to get into the group. Jason, you need to send a contact request to Sparky Dunk, SparkyDunc there on Skype. Okie doke. all that having been said, I want to run over to Ron because he's in the room with us. Because you know, technical issues like this have a much broader impact than we might initially suspect. And for those, I'm sure most people, this being you know an internet-based program, which centers on computer technology, and this being a progressive program, a lot of people are concerned about digital and electronic privacy. And so this set to between Apple and the FBI is getting really, really interesting because the FBI has an old iPhone 5C. That was the plastic cased 5 model that belonged to Syed What's-Her-Name, who was one of the two killers there in what Rafael Eduardo Cruz, the man who forgot to become an American for a really long time, likes to call San Bernardino. The FBI wants Apple to provide them with a back door so that they can unlock her phone. And Apple says no. And it's being framed as Apple ain't helping us in the war against the ISIL. And it's not really that, is it, Ron?
Nope. Not that at all. It's two conflicting philosophies compounded by a marketing opportunity. I don't know if that's succinct enough, but that's what's going on. This is a battle that goes back 20 years, even before Apple introduced the iPhone. There was a real movement back in the mid-90s to regarding encryption. Something called PGP became popular. You could get a private key, and it was essentially somewhere between $3 and $5. You could set your own level of encryption, and it was a public key, private key sort of system, the same thing that's in use today. And
there was this goes back to stuff like Pretty Good Privacy, right?
Yeah, PGP. Yeah, right. And I was fighting the war back then. At one point, I was the point man for telecom in Canada with law enforcement and all the security agencies. And this was a constant battle. And even the government realized that as much as they would like, they were going to lose the encryption battle because there was no good way they could package it so that it could be sold to the public. The worst things you had going on then were the occasional child kidnapping and pedophilia. And that wasn't enough to turn society around and get them on the government side. Things have moved on. Apple now is attempting to portray itself as a savior and guardian of individual privacy. They've been pretty darn good at it over from day one. With respect to the iPhone, less so with iCloud, but they've been okay.
I mean, yeah, there was the photos.
Yeah. But they have, what's not coming out is that they have cooperated with law enforcement on thousands of access requests for iCloud information on individuals and data files. And several hundred requests with respect to individual iPhones, and they've always provided that information. They started digging their heels in last year, I think it was September, October, some drug dealer in New York, and who eventually ended up pleading guilty. The government got him anyway. But after they introduced iOS 8, which is the next to the last version of the operating system for iPhones, full encryption was available. Everything was there. If you put in your PIN, your four-digit PIN code, and you get it wrong 10 times, the system resets itself and wipes out absolutely every data file in the iPhone. So the feds have always wanted complete access. Apple now is saying, we're not going to give it to you anymore. There is a solution to this particular problem, and Apple can easily go in using some proven techniques. They know where that pin code is stored. Get that pin code, write the sucker down on a piece of paper, reassemble the phone, give the phone and a piece of paper back to the FBI, and case closed. But the FBI seems to want a full software-written backdoor from scratch, which Apple has never done and is saying, now, nope, we're not going to do it. So it's just rife with entertainment potential. And basically, there's no way the feds can win this, simply because either Apple or individual apps that can be added onto Apple will go right back in and guarantee every bit of privacy that the FBI thinks they're going to get anyway. So,
but the larger point here, you, from your particular standpoint, Ron, you come at it from a different standpoint than I do. You come at it from a technical cybersecurity standpoint, whereas people like me and Billable Rick are prone to think about it in legal terms. You know, the Fourth Amendment says no search warrant shall issue but upon an affidavit or oath or affirmation naming the thing to be searched and the things being searched for.
Can I put that into mere mortal language as it applies to this situation?
Do please.
The feds have a right to look. They have no right to find.
Well, there's
I can hide it, but you can't find it. Well, bring all the paper you want.
Right, but beyond that, it's also a case by case basis. Just giving the federal government a back door is the essence of, in essence, saying trust me.
That's like setting up a PIN card, a bank card with a one digit security code.
Right.
The back door is going to be opened very shortly by somebody.
I'm in here.
Yeah, go ahead, Billable Rick.
Your comments make a lot of sense, Ron. Thank you. Yeah, you're most welcome. You obviously know the stuff, the technical stuff. I know the legal stuff. What it seems to be is of the government, by issuing the grand jury subpoena, I assume they issued a grand jury subpoena to Apple. You know, they're entitled to every man's evidence, so to speak. That's an old case, a quote from an old case. But I don't know that they can compel someone to create evidence to create something that wasn't in existence already. In other words, they're asking Apple to essentially write an entirely new program that allows them to access the information on this particular model of the iPhone.
Every model.
Yeah. Oh, it's every model. Okay.
Because the basic operating system and the encryption model is the same from a version started popping up in iOS 7, fully implemented in 8, is fully implemented in 9. It would give him access to everything done in 7, 8, and 9.
Jeez. Well, this case, my understanding is the magistrate judge, which is the lowest level of a federal court judge. They're not even appointed by the president. They're appointed by I think that either the district courts or the circuit courts, as the case may be. I think it's the district courts. I'm not sure. But it's a panel of judges within that area that they're appointed by. So they're not, you know, they serve for 14 years, not for life. This judge ruled, I believe, in favor of the government. But this is far from the last, the last judicial ruling in the matter. I'm sure Apple is going to appeal to the district court. You know, because the district court, you know, can set aside the magistrate judge's decision, and then it can go up to the circuit court and then finally the Supreme Court. And
yeah, but
the Supreme Court written all over it, I think.
But in paragraph 4 of the order from the judge, mm-hmm. Paragraphs 2 and 3 in the order set out the stipulations as to what Apple had to provide. Paragraph 4 said, if you can come up with a better or different technical solution for the consideration of the court, please do so.
Well, and that's and that's consistent with other lines of Supreme Court reasoning. For instance, when we talk about the first Amendment, you know, the court despises prior restraints on speech, and they will require a compelling state interest in order to support one. In other instances, you want there are other areas of law where the court is compelled to consider the least restrictive alternative. You see that in juvenile case law. And you can make that argument that should happen here. Why should the FBI get a blanket backdoor into everybody's privacy when what they need is access to a single instance? And I think that comes back home to what you said initially, Ron, namely that they're using this as leverage. Now, on the other hand, the FBI has said, the only thing that Apple is doing, this is just a marketing decision. Horseshit.
Bob, this is Todd. Can I inject in here?
Everybody, it's Friday on the front porch. Jump.
Okay. I think I'm looking at the same document that Ron and, I'm sorry, Billable.
Rick?
Okay. Are here. Paragraph 1 of this judge's decision, and I'm sorry if this throws into the weeds a little bit, of the judge's decision here. As for it going into all the phones, paragraph 1 specifies the make of the phone, Apple iPhone C, model number specified, PN number specified, serial number specified, IMEA or specific phone identified, specific carrier identified. And that's all in paragraph 1 of that. If you move on to paragraph 3 of the decision, it specifies subject device, singular, of the shooter's phone, specified device numerous times. This software is not to, and I'm paraphrasing here in a couple of places, the software is not to be installed on the phone. It is to be used on just the phone, whether it is at a government's site, or if it's more convenient, at the Apple site. And the one other point is that, let me find it here. I just lost it. It's also really technically not a backdoor. A backdoor would just allow anybody to, you know, just with, say, a given master key to go into the back door, say, your phone, anybody's phone, enter a key and go in. This is not. This is to bypass a security code that, after 10 attempts, it will erase the contents of the phone. The software that the decision is asked to bypass is the auto erase feature, so that the government can brute force attempt at numerous passwords, more than 10. They're not being asked to provide the password. They're not being asked to find a way around the password. They're all the decision is asked for is to bypass the auto erase function so that the government can attempt more than 10 passwords to get into the phone. It's not a free reign.
But I have a problem with that, because the whole point in having this auto erase feature is so if somebody gets a hold of your phone, they can, you know, well, you're not supposed to be messing with my phone, so it's going to automatically erase. So why should we give them even that?
But it's for a particular phone, not to be installed on that phone. You've got a particular phone, a particular identifier, the particular SIM card, and specified by the judge for that given phone.
But isn't that going to? But if they make this, isn't that a slippery slope? Isn't that going to just slide into somebody else's? It's like, okay, now you have the disability. You're now doing whatever they want to do to have this ability to be able to bypass the auto erase feature. Now that they have it in there, access, so you think it's not going to work on other phones?
No, it won't, because it specifies, again, in
the... Oh, my God, but just because it specifies doesn't mean it's not going to work?
Can I finish? Can I finish? It specifies in the decision that within the code that Apple is, they're asking Apple to write, that a code be included in the software that specifies that given phone, that it will not work on any other code, or I'm sorry, on any other phone.
Todd, if I could chime in, what you've said about the nature of the order appears to be supported by a Washington Post story I've just posted on the Skype chat here that basically addresses what the order requires Apple to do. I think, you know, in this given instance, I think a judge is going to be hard-pressed to tell the FBI no. I mean, these are homicidal maniacs who killed, what, 15 people to 20 people? I don't know what the number was. And any kind of information you can get as to contacts they had with other, malcreants and terrorists in the U.S. or other countries, are very important to follow up on and investigate those people. Now, obviously, I'm not one of those who trust government, just look at what happened with the NSA, spying program during the reign of error of Bush and so forth and continuing into Obama's reign. But I think in this particular instance, as long as there can be some guarantee that the FBI is not going to use this and, use this on other phones, they're going to have to go to Apple each and every time they need to do this with a phone, I think that would be okay. Then Apple would have the in-house expertise to basically prevent the data from being lost. So I think, in this instance, a judge is going to have a hard time ruling in favor of the terrorists effectively. That's the way it's going to be portrayed by the government. I think, because
there's still a problem here. As Ron pointed out, they have the Apple has cooperated time after time after time on an individual case basis. That is not what the government's asking for here, because this would not even be a controversy if the government was willing to do what Apple has done time and time and time again.
Bob, I have to correct you there. Apple did it time and time and time again, and then dug a line in the sand and said no more.
Because they were because they were getting grief from their users?
No.
Well, this is a high profile case, and if they open up the Apple case and all of a sudden it gets out into the media, these iPhones have been broken before. This one's just going to make it out into the media.
Hello,
Ron. Hey, Steve. Ron. Hey. Ron, you want to respond to that?
I'm trying to figure out how I can respond to that with violating previous oaths. One could make the case that there are some government agencies that have been breaking encryption for a long, long time and have that capability and have chosen not to share it with a domestic agency. So the capabilities are there. In Apple's particular case, they're now in a position of I think it was with a drug dealer in New York by the name of Fang, something like that, back in October. Apple said no. And everybody in the FBI went, say, what? You've always done it before. It's sort of progressed to the point now where Apple is in a position to generate probably $1 billion worth of additional sales. They will fight tooth and nail on this. They will at some point put a technical solution on the table for the consideration of a judge, as mentioned in paragraph 4 of the order. That option exists. And then the FBI will be placed on the defensive of trying to argue for something broader, because that paragraph 4 does say it must be accepted by the government. Rick mentioned that this is a judge magistrate.
Yeah, this is a magistrate. This is not an Article 3 judge.
Yes, I actually know this magistrate judge. It's Sherry Pym. I worked with her in the U.S. Attorney's Office, so it's kind of ironic that she's the judge in this high-profile case. So,
oh, I bet she's just so happy to be.
Well, yeah, and one of the things that should be noted here, and this this occurs quite often in technology cases, the law stays, and disagree if you wish, Rick. I mean, the law stays in a perpetual state of catch-up with the rest of society, because the law can only rule on things that have happened in the past. It's almost impossible for the law to rule prospectively, especially within our system. For instance, and I'm wandering off into the weeds myself, the business with Scalia's replacement. If it were not for the fact that the Supreme Court can only hear cases and controversies that are judiciable and ripe for adjudication and not mooted out and not prospective in nature, the Supreme Court could just look over to the Congress and say, you know, quit it. Send the, you know, have a hearing on the nominee. That's the law. But they can't do that because they don't have a case before them. So with that in mind, what you have and what might be needed in a more enlightened system, you need technology judges. You need judges who understand the technology, because lawyers are largely, by definition, generalists. And so lawyers are who become judges. And you're not always going to have a judge who fully understands the controversy created by the technology. Does this have any resonance for you, Ron? Or well, I see we've got Steve in the room. He's a lawyer. Billable Rick. Does this make sense?
Oh, it makes a lot of sense, Bob.
100%. 100%.
Damn it, Bob. I'm not a lawyer. I'm an engineer.
It takes a long time for the law to catch up, you know, to the current state of technology. Just for example, look at the difficulty the law has had in recent years with regard to the application of search warrants to computers. The government's not allowed to just rifle through someone's cabinets in the hope that they're going to find something. And with computers, they hold basically, like even a phone, like an iPhone, can basically hold your entire life in it, you know, emails, photos, your internet search history, important documents, any number of things. And so the law has had a very difficult time applying the Fourth Amendment reasonableness standard to searches of computer data, because heretofore, when these legal doctrines were invented, computers didn't exist. We were dealing with paper and file cabinets and so forth, and it was easy to describe what you were searching for. But with the computer, you open it up and you see all the files, and you can just kind of peruse those. I mean, if there is no Fourth Amendment, you can just look at anything, and that's not something that you're lawfully allowed to do with a search warrant. Got to be very specific as to what can be searched.
Can I say something?
Sure.
Oh no, go ahead. Go ahead, Ron. I don't want to. Since you're the computer guy.
I spent a few years working as the Canadian rep on a G8 working group on cybercrime, and even 10 years ago, we were wrestling with the issue I'm going to raise this by an order of magnitude. How do you search for something, A, in a cloud, or B, where you know it's gone across 4, 5, or 9 borders and jurisdictions in order to get back to whatever server purportedly was the source of the issue?
I was actually going to say, I was going to allude to this exact issue. And right in line with that, what I was going to say is I take my phone. I have my own law practice. And both I and any number of people can have Dropbox, can have any number of cloud applications on their phone wherein they have access to documents that are, quote, in the cloud. Where are, as Ron said, the issue then becomes, where are those documents?
Where is the cloud?
Yeah, exactly. Where is the cloud? And my concern about this, and let me just say something else about the iOS operating system. The whole 10 attempts and it erases is not an automatic thing. That's actually a setting in the phone you can set and you can undo. But anyway, my concern about this is, first of all, and I think this is actually quite unprecedented in terms of what Apple's being asked to do. I don't know that they've ever been asked to develop an entire piece of software to unlock someone's phone, number one. Number two, when I hear this, well, it's only for that phone. I'm sorry. I hearken back to all these different, you know, things I heard from Bush about, oh, we're going after very specific things. Or when this whole stuff about the NSA came out, oh, we're not actually looking at the emails. What we're doing is we're just looking at the subject headers. We're just looking at the
metadata.
Yeah. So if anyone, I'm sorry. I am like Rick said, I do not trust that the government won't take this piece of software, start using it on other things. That's the big thing. The other thing is, when they start getting into phones, you know, how do you determine where, suppose there's a document on there that somebody wrote, that it's a letter on there that somebody has on their Dropbox drive, and the court says we want to be able to get there and see that. Then you have the issue of where is that? Suppose, you know, I make the argument that I bought my phone in, you know, somewhere overseas. I bring it here. I upload these documents into Dropbox. I'm going to say, wait a minute, you American court have no jurisdiction to see these documents because I bought this phone in Europe. They're not in the United States. You don't have any jurisdiction to order me to produce them or to order anyone to.
In other words, it's not justiciable.
It's not justiciable. It's outside of the jurisdiction of the United States.
Yeah, Steve, let me just point out from a historical standpoint, how long was it after the Patriot Act was passed before we found out that, say, an FBI agent was using the Patriot Act to exact retribution on his wife's adulterous lover? Because that happened.
There you go. Well, see, that's my problem. You know, I don't like the idea. And, you know, legally, this is coming from, you know, soon to be angry black woman because I'm really tired of bullshit. And it's like, really, seriously? Do you not? I don't care what you're saying. You know, it was terrible. I was here. I wasn't in San Bernardino, but, you know, I was terrified to go because I had to go take the young man that I drive to hockey practice in Ontario. And until that was squashed, Jan was not going to let me out the house because she didn't know what was going on. And so, you know, I was indirectly affected by that. But the fact of the matter is, they use that same argument after 9/11. Well, you know, if we don't have access, you know, we're going to stop terror. And if we have access to this information, I'm sorry, you know.
You mean you don't want Big Daddy government to protect you, Tracy?
They ain't done it yet.
Yeah, right. Bush you kept know, safe, right? Didn't Bush you know, keep safe?
Yeah. Last time I checked, nah.
Except for 9/11,
other than 9/11, everything was cool, you know. Yeah, and I'm sorry. I cannot, you know, until you, and like, who's brought up, and I was sitting here listening to all the white men talk, so I'm like, okay, I'm going to talk now. And I'm like, I'm listening to you guys go on and on, and I'm like, who was the one that said, well, you don't know where you bought my, where I bought my phone, and like you said, with Dropbox and Google Drive, other people have information on my drive that, you know, documents, because I'm in school and I'm constantly collaborating on stuff from other people or what have you. So once you get into my phone, that means you can get into my Dropbox. That means you're having access to other people's stuff. And like you said, how are you going to decide once you get into my phone? That means you get to pick and choose what you get to look for? I think not. Or find somebody that you want to be looking for.
Can I get your back on this? Can I get your back on this, Tracy? Here's what I think about this. If we want to eliminate the need for this kind of surveillance, what we have is social and economic justice, where people do not feel like they have to fight
and kill people,
and do subversive shit, where we feel like we got a society that is based on justice and based on social and economic justice. And as long as we don't have that, we're going to have people that can be labeled terrorists. And we're going to have this bullshit about invading our privacy because they use the fear to turn us against ourselves so that we can never build the social justice networks that we need.
Amen. And that's exactly, and we've had these conversations before, guys. It's like, look, if I'm sorry, I mean, I'm not for people going around killing people and blowing people up, but we have got into people's countries and fucked their shit up. You know, full freaking bar. And then we sit back and just wonder, why are they mad at us? Really? Seriously? Is that because it's our American way of life? Because we have Coca-Cola and Levi's and all that. We're going in and killing their people. We're destroying their lands. We are pillaging and raping. And then you wonder why. And people just, you think, what? People are just supposed to sit back and say, okay, that's fine. People are tired. They're tired.
Hey, Tracy?
Uh-huh.
Tracy?
I'm afraid of war.
Yeah. Terrified of it. I'm afraid of war too, but we're not. But what are we doing? What are we doing to make it worse? What are we doing? We have a situation going on at my church right now, and there's a gentleman that there's a situation that's been going on for a long, over a year, which is ridiculous that it has not been resolved yet. And now he has turned from the victim to it's all his fault. Well, we're not looking at what we have done to cause the situation. And that's what I have my issues with. Nobody, I mean, except for the people within this group. And since we ain't running shit, nothing we say is going to matter. Half or never. When we have people running the show like Ted Cruz and T Rump and all these other assholes who are doing the fear and the warmongering and hate
and
all this stuff.
Yeah, ding 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 ding, because beyond the judicial ramifications of this, there are political ramifications. Now, we all know,
absolutely,
we all know that the people who are potentially voters for T-Rump or Raphael Alito or Little Marco or even Jebbia or Kasich, those are people who sit around, apparently, they wake up every morning with their pants wet, worrying about when some Arab is going to come and lop off their heads. Because they are that ignorant, they are that malleable, they are that ovine,
stupid,
if you will.
Stupid.
So this, and so I have a feeling this is going to be a problem in a political year. And it's going to be a greater problem for the Democrats than it's going to be for the Republicans. Because the Republicans can all just, you know, now that, you know, little Rand Paul and that thing on his head are out of contention. He's the only one who would have raised a sort of principled libertarian issue on this, whereas most of the Republicans will say, Well, we have to have, the FBI has to be able to look into anybody's phone that wants to keep you safe.
And if you have nothing to hide, why not allow the FBI to look?
What's the problem?
Yeah.
Yeah. What are you hiding?
What are you hiding? I'm hiding my recipes for mac and cheese, and I'm sorry. That's worth money, baby. I'm sorry.
Can I ask a question? This is Steve, by the way. What exactly is the reason that they wanted to do this anyway?
Because, you know, they're all because they're claiming, aren't they claiming, and correct me if I'm wrong, that they're trying to get more information off this phone for other sales that could be here or elsewhere? And
yes, that's exactly what they're claiming, Tracy. And
so, let me ask this question real quick, Bob, and you and Rick will understand this. Probable cause for a warrant it's going to be particularized probable cause. Well, at least that's what it's supposed to be. Notwithstanding the random searches that I have to go through in the subway every day I get down there. In any event, it's supposed to be particularized probable cause. Now, what have they articulated, or what have they said is on there, other than, well, we just want to look and see what's on there? What have they done? What has the government or the FBI said that they say is on there?
Oh, that's a very good question.
Well, they want to find out her contact information in Pakistan.
But again, how do they know that information's even on the phone?
Well, what happened is this guy
in Pakistan, wouldn't she call home once in a while?
But wait a minute. That's not the issue. The issue is, just because I think something might be somewhere doesn't give me, or doesn't give the government. Let me step back. I have litigated a million cases. I've been litigating for 10 years. I cannot demand documents from an adversary of mine because of something they might say. Because if I do that and go in front of a judge, the judge is going to say to me, what are you looking for? And if I go in there and say, well, I think this might be there. And the
judge I want to go fishing, Judge.
Yeah, I want to go fishing. I don't know what's on there. I don't really have anything to base it on. Have they produced a phone record that says, hey, she called this person?
I do know that the head of the FBI, who is it, James Comey, has testified or gave a press conference stating that they've tried to, you know, access his phone for, you know, since October or since for 2 months now, and they've not been able to do it. And interestingly, I think I might have steered this in the wrong direction. I don't think the basis for the government's the order that the government obtained was the Fourth Amendment, but rather it was the All Writs Act, which is a 1789 law used as a source of authority.
But the All Writs Act has to be subject. The All Writs, but Rick, the All Writs Act has to be subject to constitutional scrutiny. So therefore, there's going to be a Fourth Amendment issue. Now, here's another fun one, and see, this is what makes law school so fun, because people sit around and drink beer and think about esoteric shit. What rights does a dead person have? Can you violate the constitutional rights of a person who's already dead?
But wait a minute. Here's the rub. The issue here is not that – it's not like – anyone saying you can't have the phone. It's not anybody saying you can't look at it. What the judge has said, okay, you third party over here who manufactures the phone, get over here and unlock this person's phone. Now that segues into, maybe this is where you were going, Bob. At what point does Apple or some third party say, wait a minute, where's the permission of the owner of the, and actually the owner of the phone, if I remember right, was the city he worked for.
Correct.
Right, San Bernardino.
Wait, I thought this was the woman's phone.
She was issued.
Yeah, she was issued the phone.
Oh, she was issued the phone, but the husband used it. Is that it?
Right.
Okay. Wait, she was issued
the phone from San Bernardino, and the San Bernardino County granted that permission to access the phone.
They did.
Okay.
That's fine. Then it's. But the notion, and this is where that bugs me about this is the notion that a judge can order a third party to break somebody else's property. That's
a dead person can't own property, though, Steve. That's why we have rules.
No, but the dead person never owned it. The city owns it.
Well, that's true. Okay.
So imagine if I've locked my house and they wouldn't get in my house and they go to the person who made the locks and say, hey, make us a key. They're going to be like, it's not our house.
Well, actually, I've been through that exact scenario. It was years ago. It was my parents' home. I had, like a dummy, walked out of the house.
You know, locked the door.
Locked the door. And my keys and my wallet were still in the house.
Nice.
So I walked next door to use the phone. This is pre cell phones.
You would have left the cell phone in the house too, Bob.
Called the locksmith, had them come over, and they said, well, we'll be happy to unlock your door. Please show us some ID indicating that this is your house.
Yeah.
Because, see, locksmiths, by definition, carry tools that are usually referred to as burglar's tools, to mm-hmm. wit, lockpicks, that mm-hmm. if they were just ordinary people, they would be arrested for possessing.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. And he said, you know, I personally think that you are who you say you are, but
happen ever.
Absent any proof, it's my ass that's in the sling if it turns out you're going in to clean out the family silver. So away we went and we marched next door where the neighbor lady vouchsafed that I was who I said I was. Then we walked across the street where another neighbor vouchsafed that I was who I said I was. And then he said, I'm still on pretty shaky damn ground, but I'm going to take your word for it. And let me in. At which point I got the ID. I showed it to him. He was like, man. Because, you know, this was Alabama.
Oh, you're lucky you were white there, Bob.
Yes, I was.
Hey, I got something interesting here. There's
never heard the word Heideki?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. There's an interesting legal issue that arises by the government's use of the All Writs Act to compel Apple to do what the government has asked it to do. And there's a legal scholar from the University of California, Hastings College of Law, who has said basically, if the writ can compel Apple to write customized software to unlock a phone, where does it end? And then he goes on to say, can the government use it to compel Facebook, it meaning the All Writs Act, to compel Facebook to customize an algorithm that predicts crime? It's not clear where the line will be drawn, if at all. So I guess that's the real philosophical issue that permeates this whole case. That's why it's getting so
my
much...
Guys, can I get this back to something that's relevant to the immediate future? First of all, Rick, that's something that's going to take years to roll out, and I agree it's going to happen. But in the near term, first of all, let me say, apropos of the last 20 minutes, God damn, I'm glad I'm an engineer. I just have to worry about how shit works and what it means.
Are you thankful for your 20 inches of snow up there, Ron?
Well,
sorry. 75 degrees here in L.A., by the way.
Well, you know who's really dangerous, Ron? The two groups of people who usually do best in law school are the English majors and the engineers.
I've been told by many lawyers that, goddamn, I'm glad you're an engineer. So
right.
That's as far as I'll go, Bob.
I understand.
But the real point here is, and I was trying to get to it earlier, and we went off on several plateaus of digression, that this was decided by a judge magistrate. As soon as it hits the federal level, if there's a viable technical solution on the table from Apple to make this problem go away, it will go away. If it doesn't, Apple's going to ride it all the way to the Supreme Court.
Where we don't have a full...
We don't have a full kit bag right now, but it'll never get to the Supreme Court before the election. But going to be happening in an election year, and the last thing the current government wants to have is a whole investigation into Big Brother, especially when Ted Cruz is sitting here going, Big Brother is an abomination. They will shut this down too sweet, to use a Quebec phrase, as soon as they get the opportunity. It may be one level or the two levels, depending on whatever venues are picked. And right now, I'm sure they're both sides are venue shopping. But this is going to be one of those things that you're going to make go away. Except in the long term, it's not going to go away. This is one of those things, all the issues involved with the single device, with the cloud, with country borders, how do you serve a warrant, where in the hell does the data reside, et cetera, are one of those issues that lawyers are going to be putting their kids through Harvard and buying mansions on all the permutations of this issue for the next 20 years.
You almost need like an international technology court that rules in these sorts of cases, but there is no such thing.
What chance are you ever going to get for that?
Yeah.
Rick, I guess. Don't say that too loudly because Alex Jones will start hollering about how the liberals want one world government. I got a note a few minutes ago from the marvelously coherent Diane in Kansasstan when I mentioned the idea of technology judges. And Diane simply said, you mean like a high-tech FISA court? And I wrote back and said, scary, ain't it? And it is. It is.
Uh-huh.
This is.
Okay, guys. I've been a Mason for damn near 25 years. I'm willing to step up and say that the Masons would be an absolutely independent body that could adjudicate these sort of problems. And if it doesn't work for us, we'll just bump it up to the Illuminati.
Yeah, I was going to say, don't you guys control everything anyway? Don't you?
Yeah, well, I mean, you can just, and if we disagree with the Masons, we can boot it upstairs to the Shriners.
Or the Bilderbergs.
The Bilderbergs, that's right. And what about the Grove,
Bohemian Grove?
Yeah, the Bohemian Grove. How about we bring them in?
Well, they cut the Grove down, I think, so that doesn't work. I don't know if they cut it down, but...
Or we can have the Trilateral Commission.
Oh, there you go. Now you're talking.
Yeah, now the Grove is still there.
No, yeah.
Yeah, but they wouldn't cut down the Bohemian Grove.
No.
What the hell are y'all talking about?
Guys, that Bohemian Grove?
Stuff, Tracy.
I know about the Masons because, you know, anybody that watches Sleepy Hollow is all about the Masons and how they ran shit. So who are these other fools besides the Shriners?
Never mind,
because it's just something that'll...
That's a digression.
I felt the headache coming, and I'm like, stop right now.
It's a good time to use the Google.
Yeah, there you go. Thank God for Google.
Okay, can I throw one more thing out of here? Because I got to get out of here real soon.
Okay, sure.
Okay, you know, Ron had talked about the fact that Apple has done this for previous times before. Right now, all we're seeing is essentially this being done on a public stage rather than behind curtains. And if I can remember the name, there was a $1 million challenge put out for hacking the iPhone, and I can't remember what the heck it was called, Zero Dyne, something along those lines. And like anything else that claims to be hack-proof, this $1 million challenge was met almost, you know, within minutes for hacking the iPhone. So right. For any issues of people worried about chocolate chip recipes on their phone and or this particular decision you know, going down the slippery slope, and this new software that Apple's supposedly being asked to write, you know, as per the discussion in this group, it's already out there.
Then let them do it. Let the FBI do this, it.
No, it's not. It's just not been made to the government. And it's not the government that you need to be 100% worried about. They're not the ones stealing your credit cards or personal identification. You know, the slippery slope goes a lot of different ways. If you're going to start getting that paranoid, maybe you ought to start talking with the ammosexuals and the gun nuts and start arming up.
Todd,
because make a whole lot more sense than
canned goods.
The slippery slopes.
But Todd, right now they have all of those capabilities within government. They just don't want to exercise them to the extent that they can be released and made public so that it looks like Big Brother is watching. If they're absolutely 100% dead serious on getting your ass, they're going to get your ass.
Thank you very much.
And I want to say something else, too. I'm sorry, but this notion that Apple has done this before is not right. It's not right because it's not. Apple has never been commanded, not requested, they didn't request, they ordered them to develop a new software. That's where the unprecedented issue is here. Develop a new software to do this.
Well, it sounds like the Supreme Court, if that's the issue, the Supreme Court's going to say there's no fucking way you can, you know, the government can order Apple to do that, so you lose. I mean, I think if the Supreme Court's being principled about the issue, you know.
Well, and remember, Rick, you think about this too, Bob. This is in the Ninth Circuit. My hunch is if it gets to the Circuit Court, there's no way that the Circuit Court will rule in favor of the FBI. Not the Ninth Circuit will not rule in favor of the FBI here.
Yeah, and the Supreme Court, at least during the Roberts Court era, has loved to strike down Ninth Circuit decisions.
Right. That's when he was in the majority. Yeah, now you put a liberal court. See, on a completely different note, and I'll spend 10 seconds on this, I promise. This is why I think Obama was brilliant in saying he's not going to do a recess appointment, because this brings the whole notion of the Supreme Court right to the front. Okay, done with that.
Well, Supreme Court is in the front now. It's become a major
that's my point.
Issue, you know?
That's my point. That's why he didn't do a recess appointment. Because I'll tell you what, if there gets – I don't know. I'll just shut up by saying the notion, and again, I'm just repeating myself. I hope I don't sound like Marco Rubio. the notion that the government can compel not to use something that already exists, but to compel a third party who doesn't own the property, who doesn't exercise control over the property, to say, hey, third party. Yeah, fine. You manufactured it. Great. You don't own it. It's not your thing. It's somebody else's thing. You make something to break it. You make something to get in there.
Yeah, I totally agree, Steve. And another issue that arises is you're basically forcing. I mean, this is deprivation of property without due process of law. Because the government's basically telling Apple, look, or the court's telling Apple, look, you've got to create this new software, and how's it going to get compensated for doing so?
That Apple will be compensated for that.
And here's what will happen.
You check the ruling, it says that Apple will be compensated for it.
Yeah, but it ain't like they need the money.
And here's what will happen. Here's what will happen. Then the government will take it by eminent domain.
Yeah.
Well, again, as I say, if you're worried about that stuff, you better start arming yourself with the guns and the ammo.
No, I disagree.
I'm sorry, that's a silly thing to say. That's like saying, oh, if we worry about privacy at all, then I need to start arming up. Look, we've already crossed the Rubicon when it comes to giving up our privacy. I you know, it's like saying, well, you know, we've already crossed the Rubicon. Well, what's one more hole in the dam here? Well, look, if we can actually keep one hole in the dam from forming, I'm all for it.
Because it helps keep the dam from bursting.
Did I offer a piece of advice?
I'm sorry, Ron, continue, but we've heard from everybody in the group except Charlie, and I want to make sure with time running out that we hear from him. But go ahead.
Charlie's been shaking his head.
Yeah. I tell you, I don't have a Google Drive account. I don't have a Dropbox account. Everything on my phone is on an SD card. I've got an Android phone. On my Facebook page, you can go up. You might see a picture of me, but that's about it. I am scared to death to put anything out on the web, and especially in emails and anything else, because you really don't know where things are going the way packet switching works on the web. You don't know what server.
And it ain't necessarily the government you're afraid of, is it, Charlie?
Pardon me?
I said it ain't necessarily the government that you're afraid of.
Oh, no. I mean, I'm afraid of the government a little bit, you know, but I mean, there's other things too. You just don't put your personal information out on the web.
Yeah, you got that, Charlie. I live 5 miles away from the identity theft capital of the world, Glendale, California. And there's these Armenian, mainly Russian Armenian gangs, and they steal data left and right, and they basically make a living out of, you know, identity theft and fraud. It's really crazy. So I don't blame you at all.
And you can get these narcissists on Facebook. I mean, you know, they put their whole life history out there on the internet for everybody to see. And to me, that's just a little bit, you know, being a little bit stupid.
Well, it really helps law enforcement when the person does something wrong. And, you know, this stuff is like out there in social media. You know, it's amazing that people just don't seem to learn, you know?
Like, like Malheur, everything was out there in front of God and everybody.
Yeah.
And hey, I just had a really, really trenchant observation come in from Jack in Shreveport, who from time to time participates in the Skype chat group as well. Jack says, compare this legally to the government not compelling a fracking company to tell us what's in their fracking fluid when it's poisonous to people. That's, you know, versus a at best nebulous threat of terrorism. And I think that gives us a pretty good picture of the way that we, you know, of what is deemed, you know, what's deemed important to us versus what's deemed important to the government.
I think it's because of capitalism, Bob. That's the difference.
I think it is too, Rick. And hey, as we go out the door, I want to extend some thanks. Thanks, Charlie, and thank you to Daniel, Charlie, with the help of the Secret Open Carry Roundup Society, took us down to 244 to go, and Daniel, with the help of the Secret Open Carry Roundup Society, has taken us down to 209 to go. So we got $209, basically this evening's fundraising, to go to finish out the week. 209 to go, and
Bob,
7 minutes remaining in the program. Yes?
I'll put a $50 challenge out there.
Okay, so that would make you 60, and whoever, because there's, what, two slots left in the Secret Open Carry Roundup Society, availability. So that would, you know, that would get us down to 109 to go, and finishing the week, any week we finish okay, is very, very, very important. So we've got 209 to go and a $50 challenge on the table, courtesy of Steve. Thank you very kindly, Steve. But there are about 6 minutes.
Can I ask you something before we leave, Bob?
Yeah, yeah.
Your foot mat still working?
Oh, no, it's dead.
Oh, shit.
I found that out during the blizzard. but it powers. It just doesn't warm.
Can you use some snacks, Bob?
No, I'm pretty okay for snacks, and please nobody send dildos, okay?
Oh, and I wanted to ask you one other thing, Bob, before we leave. I mean, a lot of people may not know, but I sent Bob the cowbell.
Yes, the cowbell is still here.
Would you like about a 50-year-old duck call, if I can find it?
Oh, my God.
For Duck Doofus.
Oh, for Duck Doofus? Oh, my God. Yes.
Whack. They gold.
And then I can sit out in the yard and make ducks think I want to have sex with them. God, that's
hey,
gross.
Bob?
Yes, Miss Tracy.
Remember we were talking about Hamilton, and I said, you know what? It'll probably come to L.A., and guess what?
Is it?
I just got my season ticket thing for the 2016-2017 season, and Hamilton will be here next year.
I'll be dipped. Well, I know somebody's going to be there.
Yeah. Jan was like, well, why do we want to see that? Just shut up, woman, and just let me pay for these tickets, okay? That was my response. It's like, shut up, woman, and let me do this. And then she shut up.
Hey, guys, can I offer, before my cold defeats me totally, excuse me, totally, can I offer one piece of extraneous advice?
Do please.
If you want to have the best currently possible security, get yourself an iPhone through an agent from Switzerland. There's three or four carriers. And then let the bastards try to break into it.
I will never own a smartphone.
Some of us.
And I don't know how many. And where am I going to find a carrier from Switzerland?
There's agents you can contact. They'll set you up with a phone from Switzerland. You can encrypt it. You can put password protection on it. They'll ship it to you, and then you can use it in the U.S. The only issue is it'll cost you about five times what a U.S. carrier would charge for equivalent service. And don't
I'm not
use
rolling like that.
Ron, that'll okay. work until the IRS requires all of us to disclose our Swiss iPhones on our tax return.
That's fine. You can let them know you got one and what you pay for it.
Yeah.
You still can't crack it.
Wow.
Well,
there you
if I ever get to that point, Ron, where I can roll like that, I will do that. Because I, like I tell Bob all the time, the best revenge will be for me to become a very wealthy, angry black lesbian. And that would be one of the first things I would get and be like, Fongool. What?
And, of course, we don't, the cycle that we're on now, the next iteration of the iPhone will be the 7, and it will be out. It'll be announced in September and available for purchase in October.
Oh, yeah. I was really trying. This is the first iPhone that I bought that was on the even numbers. I always buy, my first one was the 3, then I got the 5, and I had planned on waiting until the 7, but my 5 just gave up the ghost. And I'm like, God damn it. I haven't had too many issues with this one. But I just feel weird. I feel off kilter because I have an iPhone. Well, I do have the iPhone 6S, but still, I'm just like, ugh. Because I just, you know, but, and I will not buy another iPhone until, you know, I typically can hold on to my iPhone for almost 3 years.
Yeah, well, I mean,
but Tracy,
my it's a matter of taste. I just don't like the Android operating system.
About Android and Google at all tonight. That could tie up a whole other night.
I have both, and I don't like the Droid as much as I like. There's just too much that I have to think about with my Droid. Even though I love my phone, I have the Note 6, I mean the Note 4, and I love that phone.
I'm a Droid guy myself.
Bob has to go. Malloy starts right at
Starts at the top now, so we got to get out of here. Thanks, everybody. And again, bye. $50 challenge on the table. Thank you, one and all. And, well, if the challenge gets met, then there's $109 to go to finish the week. Thank you, thank you, thank you to everybody. We have had an awesome string of Friday on the Front Porches for about the last 2 months. And I want to thank everybody for their participation this evening. And a reminder that the Horn Molloy Skype chat group will continue at about 11 Eastern time, 8 Pacific, after Molloy closes. So thanks, everybody. Have a wonderful weekend. And, well, more Ann Monday will be here before you know it. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Good night, y'all, and good weekend.